Weather, the economy, and more. Catch new Climate Connections Mondays through Fridays here on 90.1 FM KPFT.
90.1 KPFT FM HD2 Houston.
Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT 90.1 HD2, where we discuss local, state, national, and international stories. My co-host is Andrew Ferguson.
Hi there, folks.
First, I just want to remind you folks that if you're eligible, do make sure you're registered to vote. If you haven't registered in time for the primary, you can still register to vote for the rest of the year, so don't be discouraged by that. You can track your mail-in ballot activity, whether it's an application or a vote, by going to harrisvotes.com/tracking. And all of this is on the show post at thinkwingradio.com. Primary election is March 1st for in-person. Early voting ends February 25th. And the last day for receipt of a marked ballot by mail is March 1st. If it's not postmarked, March 3rd, if it is. I will remind you that if you have not already applied for a ballot by mail for the primaries, you can still apply for a ballot by mail for some other reason for the rest of the elections this year. However, you must always mail the application. You cannot email it. You cannot fax it. You can. It just won't help.
Yeah.
So, anyway, let's see. Community Impact, which is a source that I cite quite a bit, is doing a number of articles on getting to know the candidates in a number of primary races. You can go to communityimpact.com. They've been running these stories since at least the 11th, so you might have to scroll back a little bit or do a search for your district or your senatorial district or whatever. Also, remember, you can get voting information at vote411.org, and there are some useful tools there. Okay, getting to localish stories from communityimpact.com. Highway 288 expressway rates rise. Now, first of all, I got to tell you, I didn't even realize that any portion of 288 was a toll road. And then it was like, well, is it like an HOV toll, but part of the road is free, or is it a total? I was very confused. So as I'm reading this story, if you have questions come to mind, believe me, they were mine. I'll try to clarify if necessary as I go. Drivers utilizing the Brazoria County portion of the Highway 288 toll road, the Brazoria County Expressway, saw the first rate increase in 13 months of the tollway's existence. The Brazoria County Toll Road Authority on January 10th raised the rates of the two gantries. That was my first thing, like, what's a gantry? Not a like a toll booth? Anyway, I think they mean toll booths. The rates of the two gantries where drivers are charged for using the express lanes, again, that's where I got confused, to a total of $2.65 heading north or southbound, charging $1. I'm telling you, this is hard. They're charging $1 at the CR 58 gantry and $1.65 at the McCard Road gantry. Previous rate was $1.80 anyway. According to engineer Matt Hanks, not Tom, maybe a relative, we felt it was the right thing to do as a toll road authority. I'm not sure that there is a right thing for a toll road authority to do, but we're going to leave that aside. The Highway 288 toll road extends from CR 58 in Pearland to Highway 59 in Houston, heading both north and south. Now, this is, again, where I got confused, because if it's a toll road and it extends from CR 58 to Highway 59, it's like, does that mean that now 288 is a toll road from 288? Not as near as I can determine, okay? Harris County's toll road portion extends from 59 to Clear Creek and is maintained and operated by the Blue Ridge Transportation Group through a public-private partnership. And said Rainice Edwards, public information officer for PTG Highway 288. The BTG does not maintain nor operate Brazoria County's portion, Hank said. The toll rates on Highway 288 Expressway are dictated by the market share, inflation rate, and congestion, Hanks said. On December 1st, 2020, the Harris County portion charged drivers traveling through all three Harris County gantries $5 to $6.30, depending on time of day and driving direction, according to the 288 website, which provides drivers with the daily rates of the Highway 288 Express lanes in Harris County, set by the BTG. As of press time, which is the story, on February 8th, rates have increased to $10.59 to $11.51 for the same trip, according to the Drive 288 website. Brazoria County increased its toll rate January 10th due to Harris County's increased rates. How thoughtful. The BTG reviews Harris County's rates of the Highway 288 managed lanes on a monthly basis, Edwards said, but it can also fluctuate every 30 minutes. So you're playing craps on the toll road now, depending on demand and time of day. Brazoria County's rate does not fluctuate, Hank said. Edwards said, depending on the customer, we have received complaints on pricing. However, we have also received compliments related to the time savings for travel. Brazoria and Harris counties raised the rates for their respective portions of the Highway 288 Expressway. Brazoria County's rate has risen 85 cents since December 2020. Harris County's has risen by more than $5. There are so many questions I have in this story because I don't live or go to that part of town. Yeah. So, I mean, this was very confusing to me because they talked about the expressway, but they also talked about express lanes. They talked about the tolled portion going from 59 inside of Houston to County Road 59, I think it was, or 58. And then the Brazos portion. I mean, there was a lot of very confusing, apparently contradictory stuff. I did some research, and as best as I can figure out, for people that don't live in that neck of the woods and don't already know, I think that what they're saying is that Harris County essentially has express lanes, or maybe HOV lanes, that go from 59 to the end to that county road.
Okay.
And I think that from up to that point, you have free lanes and then you have the express portion. I think that after that, in the Brazoria County portion, the whole thing is an expressway with tolls. Okay. Now, of course, what I have to love about this, I mean, depending on the customer, we've received complaints on pricing, but also compliments related to time savings. I can tell you probably with a degree of certainty that the people complaining about pricing can't afford it, and the people complaining about that are complimenting about time savings can.
Yeah.
I think it's also kind of funny, not ha-ha funny, when we think about the fluctuation of rates over time. Every 30 minutes it can fluctuate. So if you can afford the uncertainty of what you're going to pay for a toll, head on out there. If you can't, you have to be either watching your app or listening to your app, if that's a possibility, and deciding whether you're going to take the toll road or the toll lanes or the frontage road, or if there is a portion that doesn't have frontage road, in order to force you to take the toll road, you then have to decide whether you're getting on or taking a coffee break somewhere. Mm-hmm. You know, you and I have talked a number of times about how I view toll roads as basically classism.
Yeah.
You know, roads for the rich, the peons take the frontage road. Or as I think the term came from 1984, the book, the proles. The proles take the frontage road. It's offensive to me, and you know, they added a toll section on 249 going up to Austin, going up to Tomball, and 290 going up to Austin. It's just appalling.
Yeah. Andrew? Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, let's sort of add this all up and do a little bit of math here. So the new rates now are for the Harris County portion are $10.59 to $11.51. Let's take the maximum there, which is $11.51. Add that to the solid $2.65 in Brazoria. So essentially now, in order to cross the entire Houston metro area on Highway 288, you are going to have to pay at maximum over $14 just one way.
Each way.
Each way.
So if you're a low-wage worker, you can spend one day out of five paying for your car fare.
Yeah, absolutely. If you go to work 5 days a week, both ways. Yeah. And, you know,
imagine having multiple part-time jobs where you're having to take this road. It doesn't pay to work.
Yeah. And they may sort of argue this as a congestion reduction measure. And I mean, I'll give them credit here. If they're trying to reduce congestion, it's going to work because nobody's going to take 288 to cross the metro area anymore. There, you know, I don't know if there are going to be frontage roads on all of the, portions of 288 that would be tolled that you could take as an alternate, but people may end up having to take one of the loops instead and, you know, have to deal with all that because
you can always take Highway 3, which is, you know, a slower road.
Yeah.
I mean, the alternatives here are where do you want your traffic? Do you want your traffic on the highway or do you want your traffic on the frontage road?
Yeah.
If you have traffic on the frontage road, it's slower, stop and go, more air pollution, more time consumption.
Yeah.
More expensive in terms of fuel because, you know, consumption is higher. And all you're doing is shunting the traffic from the highway because it's too expensive to the frontage road because it's free.
Yeah.
Now, there was a time on 610, and I have to tell you, because it's been a while since I've commuted, I don't know that they're ever turned on now. I don't think they are. I don't recall seeing them recently. But they used to have metered entrance ramps on 610. I mean, the lights are still there. They just don't work.
Okay.
And the premise to that was they didn't want the traffic backing up on 610. So they figured if you had like maybe 10 seconds or 5 seconds or something between cars, a car would enter 610 and then you would wait until your turn came when the light turned green and then you would enter 10. Now, of course, what would then end up happening is on very heavy days, the car in front of you that was metered ahead ends up getting stuck trying to enter the traffic flow. So you end up bumper to bumper with them anyway.
Yeah.
Assuming that that is not the case and that traffic is moving quickly enough so that you can kind of merge, all you're doing now is backing up the traffic to the frontage road, which can make it harder for people to get in and out of driveways or get through intersections or whatever. You know, it's all traffic shunting.
Yeah.
So I don't find this kind of thing useful unless, like in Manhattan, when they make these really expensive toll bridges. Because remember, four out of the five boroughs in New York are islands.
Yeah.
So the only one that's connected to the U.S. mainland is the Bronx. To get to Manhattan, you must go through a tunnel or a bridge or a ferry. There's just no other choice.
Right.
So essentially what the New York City government has said is you are not welcome to drive your car into Manhattan. And if you wish to drive your car into Manhattan, they've made it really expensive to do so, both in terms of toll roads, bridges, tunnels, but also in terms of parking garage taxes.
Yeah.
So it can cost you. I mean, I haven't been there in quite a while. I think when I was there a few years ago, it was already like $25 for 4 hours or something.
Jesus.
Yeah. I mean, essentially what they're saying is you're not welcome.
Yeah.
You know, if you want to come in, take a bus or a train. Otherwise, we really don't want you here. And essentially, is that what they're saying in Houston? Are they saying, we just don't want you driving here? Because if that's the case, they need to do a whole lot more in terms of mass transit, whether it's light rail or buses.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the reality of implementing mass transit in a city like Houston is obviously different from a city like New York, or really pretty much any northeastern city, because the densities are so totally different. But that doesn't mean that it's an idea, or that it's that no effort should be made. You may not be able to get everything working with absolute maximum efficiency. You may not be able to get everyone exactly within, you know, a mile of where they need to go. But if you're going to put this kind of restrictive measures in place on driving in order to try and reduce congestion for the people who do absolutely have to drive, you have to provide some sort of reasonably competent alternative. And they just haven't done that.
Well, I'll tell you what I started to do before I moved out of New York. I used to be able to go door to door from my apartment to my job 45 minutes. Mm. I was in Southeast Brooklyn, bus, train, get out on 42nd Street, walk to my job, 45 minutes. Incrementally over years, because of budget cuts, they would spread out the trains by 2 minutes, and then by 2 minutes, and then by 2 minutes. And by the time I was done, my last job in Manhattan, I was taking 75 minutes each way.
Jeez.
So essentially, the trip had added a half an hour just because of budget cuts.
Yeah.
At that point, I decided I was no longer going to look for a job in Manhattan.
Mm.
And from then on, it was Brooklyn, Queens, or Long Island. That was the only place I would look.
Yeah.
And essentially, the question is, if you're going to make it so difficult to get a job in Houston, do you want people to be looking for jobs in Houston?
Mm.
Because if it's so expensive to get a job in Houston, there is a pay scale where it no longer pays to get a job in Houston. And ironically, those are the very people they need to have jobs in Houston, because those are the low-skilled, which for a while were essential, which are now back to being low-skilled workers.
Yeah.
And those are the people that really don't make enough to take this kind of road.
Yeah.
But those are the people you need to support the people that are doing the better paid. I mean, it's crazy. And I don't know that there's a clear solution either way, but this isn't it in my
mind. Absolutely.
Okay. You are listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT 90.1 HD2, Houston's community station. We air Wednesdays at 11 a.m. Central, and you can hear the show either live online at kpft.org. You can podcast it, or you can go to archive.kpft.org for older shows. Every show that I refer to or read portions of on the show is heavily excerpted, so I put links to the full articles on my blog at thinkwingradio.com. Just click on show posts and more at the top of the page. Find the post for the show or show date you're looking for. You can also type keywords into the search bar. And we're on social media, where we can take questions, comments, and suggestions. Check the show's Facebook page at Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig, and look for me on Twitter at Think Wing Radio. Plus, Andrew has his social media accounts.
I sure do. You can find me on Twitter at DominateEYE, and spelled the same on Tumblr at DominateI.tumblr.com.
Okay, our next story is from the Texas Tribune. Our last story, by the way, was from Community Impact. I just like to give them credit. Unhoused Texans weather another winter storm with little aid. Advocates say emergency communications have not improved much since last year, and people experiencing homelessness were less likely to seek help this year because of new state and local policies targeting them. After a deadly freeze last year in which the unhoused were among the most vulnerable, local officials vowed to do a better job next time. Every time I read that line, I think of every time I do my taxes, I vow I'm going to do a better job next year.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly with emergency communications, they went on. But during last week's storm, many unhoused Texans still did not have adequate information from municipalities about where to find shelter and how to get there. And compounding the problem, advocates say recent state and local policies that target people experiencing homelessness have made unhoused Texans more hesitant to seek help. In Austin, the city had a year to prepare and broadcast a plan for cold weather shelter in the case of a dramatic freeze, said Scott Hoft, an organizer with Stop the Sweeps Austin, a local advocacy group against clearing of homeless encampments. He went on, the city left houseless people, their friends, and service providers wondering what the plan was. In Houston, officials are reporting at least three people without shelter died when temperatures dropped last week. It's unclear how many people died or required treatment across the state after being exposed to the cold during this year's winter storm. One of the biggest takeaways from last year's storm at both the state and local levels was the need to improve emergency communications. During the freeze, Texas failed to provide accessible and life-saving updates on outages and inclement weather. A November audit of Austin's 2021 storm response, last year's that is, found that the city left many residents without critical information and did not effectively reach people experiencing homelessness. A year later, advocates report a similar break in communication. When local governments do not meet the needs of unhoused people, organizers say they are forced to mobilize even when they are strapped for resources. In Houston, volunteers of the Black Trans Texas Connection picked up unhoused people and transported them to the group's shelter, Thrive House. The group housed 17 people during last week's storm, organizers said. Black and trans residents are especially vulnerable and are among the last to get accepted into a shelter or have access to a safe environment, said Black Trans Texas Connection founder Sarah Pope. Houston, at the time, was advising residents against travel. Pope said the city should have hired staff to transport people to shelters so she and other organizers wouldn't have to put themselves at risk. Of course, I have to insert here, that would be still someone putting themselves at risk. An affordability crisis is driving an increase in homelessness across the state. Texans are moving out of metropolitan areas, driving up the cost of housing in rural areas. Do you remember we talked about this March in 2020? How that could happen?
Mm-hmm.
Said Tricia Silva, the executive director of the Bastrop County Emergency Food Pantry. In Bastrop County, a mostly rural region 30 miles southeast of Austin, a growing unhoused population has resulted in a greater demand for food, shelter, and resources. So again, just shunting the problem around. The greater demand for shelter can be especially challenging for rural counties where resources can be more limited. Bastrop County has just one shelter that opens during bad weather conditions. County officials also opened warming centers last week. Nick Thompson, the statewide initiatives manager at the Texas Homeless Network, said recent state and local efforts targeting homeless people make Texans less likely to seek help. The legislature passed House Bill 1925 last year, which amounts to a statewide ban on homeless camping. Texans now face a fine of up to $500 and a Class C misdemeanor if they camp in public places. Well, at least the homeless don't have to break a window now to get a warm cell, right? The city of Austin, which has struggled with a rise in homelessness, reinstated a local camping ban last year. This really incentivizes folks a lot of times, Thompson said, to stay out of the public eye so that they're not going to be contacted by the police, so they're less likely to be found or called upon by law enforcement officers. William, a homeless man, has been without shelter since he was 18 years old. He began in Austin with his wife for 7 years. Since camping in public places was made a criminal offense, he's been subject to city sweeps of homeless encampments during which cleanup crews have taken his belongings. He said that, now mind you, if you're evicted from a home, they can't even do that.
Mm.
William said that while he and other unhoused people in Austin managed to get through another winter storm, the dehumanization of people experiencing homelessness will continue. And this is a powerful statement at the end. He says, we can't sleep, so we're always tired. We can't make a job interview because we're always worried about the Austin Police Department taking our stuff. It sucks being homeless here now. I had people that used to look out for me, William said. The only difference an ice day and a non-ice day makes is ice. These things don't change year round. I know we've been talking about the homeless a lot over the last few shows. Maybe it's because of the cold weather that it's top of mind. Of course, when you're a homeless person, it's always top of mind.
True.
Andrew, I'm going to let you comment on this. I'm going to take a moment here.
Sure. Well, I mean, I think there's an obvious, effective, and extremely unlikely solution to the broader issue of houselessness. Unsold homes should be given for free to unhoused people. Failing that, public land is intended for public use, and camping should be protected as a legitimate public use. Because and this is part of the reason that the alternate label of houseless rather than homeless has been proposed, I gather.
I first encountered that in Hawaii, actually.
Yeah, because the city,
they can't afford, they have full-time jobs and they can't afford any place to live.
Right. The city, the location where they're living, that is their home. They have a home. It is that area. They just don't have a house. And so, you know, they are members of that community. They are the public in that community. The uses that they have for public land are public uses. I will say there are a couple really good ideas in this article. City transport to shelters during emergencies, I think, is a great idea. You did mention that it is true that it would still mean that somebody is being, you know, is risking themselves.
Somebody is still transporting somebody, and somebody is still putting themselves at risk. The difference right. is, if it's the city doing it, they may have an appropriately sized and safe vehicle for the purpose.
Exactly. And they have the ability to, you know, to properly train people on in how to drive in ice and snow and these sorts of things. And they have the ability to outfit these vehicles as well, specifically for that kind of weather. But I also think that even just, you know, outside of emergencies, public transit routes should add shelters as stops and offer free rides to anyone who's getting off there. That's, you know, an idea that can be sort of workshopped. It's, you know, sort of just popped into my head. But, you know, I think that there needs to be this sort of more support for houseless people, not just in, you know, in getting them somewhere to live and getting them a place to work and getting them food to eat and this sort of thing, but even just to respect their dignity a little bit more. But of course, all of this would require officials to actually want to end homelessness, which some of them do, absolutely, but the majority of them don't, because having a bunch of desperate people ready to do whatever terrible job you can't get anybody else to do is quite useful to the people in power, I think.
Okay, as on that last point, I think that there is a topic of discussion there whether the elites, and I'm going to start using maybe some of your language now, if the elites or capitalist class wants to keep a certain number of people poor so that they can get them to do the cruddy jobs that they, that nobody else wants to do, you know, that is like a whole other philosophical and sociopolitical discussion to have.
Okay.
I think that, you know, we've talked about hostile design,
mm-hmm.
where there's no place you can lie down.
Yep.
If you find a place to lie down, you're rousted.
Mm-hmm.
You can't camp because it's illegal to camp. And yet even camping isn't exactly what you call shelter. It means you won't get
yeah.
wet. And maybe if you have a heater, which, you know, costs money and fuel and stuff, it'll sort of hold in the heat a little bit. But ultimately, people need a place to be.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you know, it's almost like you're saying, well, we're not going to do euthanasia, but we're going to make it hard for them to live.
Yeah.
And I exactly. mean that in the literal sense, not just, you know, place to live. I mean, to live.
Yeah.
There has to be a solution. You shouldn't just be able to take or destroy people's property. Mm-hmm. I don't care if they're camping out or not. Maybe you take possession of it, you know, like you tow away a car and you impound it. Even that is not a great solution, but at least it's not expropriating people's property,
yeah.
which in every other class in this country would be illegal without due process. Hmm. There is no due process when they bring a bulldozer and just bulldoze away an encampment. That's not yeah. due process.
Yeah.
That's just destruction. So I guess this is a story we'll probably talk about again. I don't necessarily agree with all of your comments about, you know, vacant housing being mm-hmm. given to the homeless. That's, again, expropriation of property, which belongs to somebody. But housing, whether it's tiny housing or using public property to establish tiny housing communities, helping people who want to get off the street to do so, because if you're always tired and you always stink and you don't have a phone and, you know, I mean, there are certain things you need to be able to get a job to get off the street if it is yeah. your desire to do so. If
yeah.
you have mental health issues, you need to be able to get treatment for that. And if you're willing or desirous of just, you know, being houseless, let's say, you know, then maybe something that's 100 square feet that at least has heat and sanitary facilities, if that's all you need, maybe society needs to provide that
mm.
in some kind of a controlled area where, you know, you're not impinging on other people's lives, but you're given the opportunity to live as a human being. You know, I think all of us at some point need to say there, but for the grace of God, go I.
Mm-hmm.
Because Absolutely. Some of us more than others.
Yeah.
Okay. You are listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1 HD2, airing Wednesdays at 11 a.m. Central. You can also hear the show at kpft.org. You can podcast it, which I would recommend. You can go to archive.kpft.org to listen to older shows of Think Wing Radio and any of the 100 other shows that are aired on KPFT. KPFT is Houston's community station with over 100 individual titles. To do that means we need community support to keep giving you that unique and varied programming. You can go to the new KPFT.org webpage. It really is new. It's kind of pretty. You can hit the donate button, and all donations are tax deductible. Pick your favorite show, hopefully ours, and the amount of your donation, large, smaller, in between. And you may even qualify for a lovely thank you gift. And remember, spreading the word helps us too, and it's free. Okay, the next story. Texas has new political maps, as you may have heard. See which district your home is in. And this is a great link. It's on the Texas Tribune. And, of course, I have a link to it on my website, thinkwingradio.com, for today's show. Texas lawmakers having redrawn political maps for the state's congressional, House, Senate, and Board of Ed districts. However, the maps face at least five legal challenges, including one from the U.S. Department of Justice, based on claims that the newly drawn districts discriminate against voters of color. You can go to this article, and if you enter your address, it'll customize the page so that the new districts will show you how they affect your community. Just put in your address. It's a great link. It will show you that how the boundaries have changed before and after for all your various districts. It's a great tool, which is why I mention it. I recommend going there.
Mm. It also analyzes the political and race makeup of each district. And going to this tool and putting in my address, this is how I found out that my house has been shifted into a new congressional district, or I suppose new to me at the very least. That is heavily concentrated Democratic and Black. Now, I'm not too opposed to being in this district, but what concerns me about it is that it looks like it is a concentration of those kinds of voters, Democratic voters and Black voters.
You get packed and, or cracked. You were packed.
Exactly. I think this is packing to concentrate them in this district, this U.S. congressional district, so that the surrounding districts do not have more competitive races for Republicans. So,
okay. Yeah, it's a thing. And we're going to talk about that a little bit more now. Voter turnout in Texas primaries is dramatically low. It's always dramatically low. Texas has a history of a dismal turnout rate in primary elections. And with early voting underway, here's how redistricting and new voting restrictions could exacerbate low participation. New political maps and voting laws could create more obstacles. I'm not excerpting the article because I feel like the headline and the subhead are pretty much the story. As always, you can click on the show link for the full story, but the headline is to do your best to vote. There are going to be new obstacles. If you're voting in person, vote as early as you can. If you're voting by mail, try to make your decisions and mail your ballot as soon as possible. If you have a paper ballot and decide you want to vote in person, bring your paper ballot with you so it can be spoiled, and then you can vote as you normally would in person. In Harris County, the good news is that there will be new voting machines that generate a paper trail. The bad news is that there are new voting machines, so expect the process to be slower than it will be as people and election officials, their learning curves improve. Try to be patient with lines. Try to be patient with the machines. We'll get through it. We have to get through it because elections have consequences. Increasingly, they have consequences. Andrew?
Well, I wanted to also add something that I think is kind of contributing to the confusion. It's Texas primary participation rules. Because in Texas, if you vote in the Democratic primary, you can't vote in the Republican one. And this goes for minor parties as well. If you vote at a Green nominating convention, you cannot vote in, for example, the Democratic primary. If you sign any candidates, no matter who they're affiliated with, what party, or if they're independent, if you sign any candidate's ballot access petition, a petition to get them onto the ballot at the general election, that counts as your primary vote. You cannot vote in any primary or convention if you sign that form.
Well, but I think the clarification there would be that you have to vote in that party's primary of the candidate of the petition that you signed.
that is what it's counting.
No one can know what who you're voting for in the voting booth for a primary, but you would be obligated to vote in the primary of the party of the petitioner.
I don't know if that's actually true. I think that, you know, the assumption or the I guess it is an assumption. The assumption that minor parties have been operating on when they haven't been able when they haven't automatically been on the ballot is we need to find people who haven't voted in the primary to sign our ballot.
Yes. Again, for the same reason.
For the yeah. Well, that's because that's what it counts as. It counts as your primary vote. Effectively, the state
it,
of
it
Texas.
It counts as your party selection for the primary.
Yeah, I'm not even sure if you can vote in the primary of the party that, you know, the candidate that you selected, that you signed.
Yeah, you can.
Okay. All right.
I'm going to say that with about a 99% certainty.
Okay. Well, anyway, regardless of everything else, and I mean, you know, this discussion is kind of the emblematic of the fact that it's confusing.
Yeah, it's kind of, we're not sure. We're debating it.
Yeah. But regardless of all this, you can vote however you like in the general election. Whatever you vote in the primary does not affect your vote in the final election. You know, I think
so if you vote in the Democratic primary and you decide to vote for a Republican, maybe it's just one Republican, you can.
You can do that. You can absolutely do that. But, you know, there's a lot of people who don't know that. There's a lot of people who don't understand the rules around primary participation or ballot access. And so, you know, I think all of these complicated primary rules are certainly playing their part in, you know, creating obstacles, getting, you know, stopping people from voting with confidence or having people's votes thrown out because they've, you know, contradicted the law in ways that they didn't realize.
Or fear that they're going to contradict the law, yeah. Which is another voter suppression tactic.
Absolutely. You know, I think it might be worth considering if we look at the various different types of primaries that different states use and see if a different style may work better for, you know, generating less confusion, helping
people
be more confident.
Well, of course, you're assuming that that's the point. You know, it's kind of like under the Trump regime, the cruelty was the point.
Yes.
In Texas, the voter suppression, the challenge, the difficulty, the lines, it's not a bug, it's a feature.
Right.
And if I think given the government and kind of government we currently have in Texas, if they learn anything from other states, it's going to be how to be better at voter suppression.
Yeah.
I think that's the place where the state is at right now. Mm. Okay, moving on. More good news. Texas ban on encouraging mail-in votes. Actually, maybe this isn't bad news. I'll start it again. Texas ban on encouraging mail-in votes, likely unconstitutional, judge rules. The challenged provision makes it a – now, the provision that is potentially unconstitutional makes it a state jail felony for election officials to, quote, solicit the submission of an application to vote by mail if the voter did not request it. This is kind of interesting. It gets tricky. And this is only a portion of a very interesting article. A new Texas law that keeps local election officials from encouraging voters to request mail-in ballots likely violates the First Amendment, a federal judge ruled late Friday. Following a testy three-hour hearing earlier in the day, federal district judge Javier Rodriguez temporarily blocked the state from enforcing the rule against Harris County's election administrator until the rest of a lawsuit plays out. Although the scope of Rodriguez's preliminary injunction is limited, the judge dealt the first legal blow to new election restrictions and voting changes Republican lawmakers enacted last year. The injunction applies to Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton and local county prosecutors in Harris, Travis, and Williamson counties. The state is expected to quickly appeal the ruling. The lawsuit was brought by Harris County Election Administrator Isabel Longoria and Kathy Morgan, a volunteer deputy registrar who is appointed to help register voters in Travis and Williamson counties. February 18th is the last day for counties to receive applications for mail-in ballots for the March 1 primary. Rodriguez took particular issue with the lack of a clear definition for what constitutes soliciting when talking to voters, even those 65 and older who automatically qualify to vote by mail under the state's strict rules. It has a chilling effect, Rodriguez said while questioning a state attorney on Friday morning. They don't know when they're going to run afoul of this vague law. His comments followed testimony from Longoria and Morgan, who said they feared civil and criminal penalties that could come from violating the broad prohibition. Longoria said her office was now taking a passive approach to voter outreach in regard to voting by mail, with staffers gingerly, using her word, weighing their words while answering voters' questions about their options. Longoria said from the witness stand, "When it comes to voting by mail, I have to be very careful with my words. I stop mid-sentence sometimes at town halls. I'm tentative to overreach at the moment." Eventually, Will Thompson of the Texas Attorney General's office told Judge Rodriguez that the provision was meant to limit, quote, official encouragement of voting by mail, indicating the state preferred people vote in person, even if they qualified to vote by mail. Thompson said, quote, "We're not taking the position that the legislature is opposed to voting by mail. That doesn't mean the legislature wants resources to be used toward nudging people toward voting by mail," unquote. Basically, they don't want you to vote. The Harris County lawsuit is just one in a heap of challenges to the election law SB 1. The expansive fight against the law includes civil rights groups and community organizations that advocate for voters of color and voters with disabilities who argue the law discriminates against those voters. The U.S. Department of Justice joined those plaintiffs with its own lawsuit last year, targeting new restrictions on mail-in ballots and voter assistance. Those cases are expected to go to trial later this year. You know, I remember a few years ago, the Texas Democratic Party took the Republican Party to court, claiming that they had selectively gerrymandered their districts in order to favor Republican candidates.
Yeah.
And the Republicans were so bold as to say in court, the lawyer for them did, that, sure, we actually did gerrymander the districts to discriminate against Democrats. That doesn't mean we were discriminating against people of color, which would have been a civil rights violation.
Yeah. I remember
actually
that.
Said that in court. So in other words, if you're a Democrat and you're not a person of color, they don't have to worry about violating your civil rights because your ability to vote in a competitive district is not a constitutional right. It doesn't say that anywhere in the Constitution. It says the states can basically make election rules as they wish. So we have a long way to go. You know, I was listening, I think it was maybe Friday, I was listening to a news program and someone made the point that if we're not careful, we may end up being a country. Actually, I think it was Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, AOC, who made the comment when she was giving an interview that if we're not careful, within 10 years, we may be a country that postures as a democracy, but won't actually be one. I think that that's a real danger. Andrew?
Well, I mean, I would argue we're already there because any country, any democracy where you can buy power, is it really a democracy? But anyway, as for this particular story, I'm really hopeful that this is going to start the unraveling of all of SB 1. It's all designed to make it harder to vote, and it should all be found unconstitutional, I think.
You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1 HD2, airing Wednesdays at 11 a.m. You can also hear the show live online at kpft.org, podcast it on your phone's podcast app, or by visiting archive.kpft.org. Every story on the show is heavily excerpted, which is why we include links to the full stories on my blog at thinkwingradio.com. Just click on show posts and more at the top of the page, find the post for the show or date you're looking for, or type keywords into the search bar. We're also on social media where we can take questions, comments, and suggestions. Check the show's Facebook page at Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig and look for me on Twitter at Think Wing Radio. And of course, Andrew, you have your accounts.
I sure do. You can find me on Twitter at DominateEYE and spelled the same on Tumblr at DominateI.tumblr.com.
Okay, the next story is kind of interesting because in a way, the Texas Tribune has done the very thing that they're saying is a problem. You'll see as I read. Republican incumbents hold big leads in statewide March primary races, UT poll says. The poll shows Governor Greg Abbott and Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick have a significant advantage over their primary opponents. Democratic respondents heavily support Beto O'Rourke for governor, but don't know enough about the party's candidates in other races. Governor Greg Abbott and Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick and Attorney General Ken Paxton are head and shoulders above their competition in the Republican primaries, according to responses from the 41% of surveyed voters who said they would vote in the Republican primary. Paxton, who is the most likely of the three to be pulled into a runoff, faces the most significant competition in his race. On the Democratic side, former presidential candidate Beto O'Rourke was the choice for governor of 93% of polled voters who said they would vote in the Democratic primary. But below O'Rourke on the ticket, down ballot, as they say, a majority of voters said they had not thought enough about the down ballot Democratic primaries to make an immediate choice between candidates, a sign that the party still has significant work to do to introduce its candidates to voters and disrupt the longtime Republican hold on the state. In a hypothetical matchup right now between O'Rourke and Abbott, the leading primary candidates in their respective parties, the poll found Abbott would win the race for the governor's mansion by 47-37. The 10-point predicted victory nearly matches the result of a 9-point win for Abbott when the same question was asked in a UT Tribune poll from November. Joshua Blank, research director for the Texas Politics Project at UT, said that given recent election results in Texas that have seen Democrats lose by margins smaller than 10 points, Blank said there is still potential for a shift in public opinion, either toward Abbott or toward O'Rourke over the next couple of months leading into the general election. And here we get into some statistics. I just want to point out, just in the middle of this, the Tribune article says that the reason that Democratic voters have trouble picking any Democrats for the primary below O'Rourke is because they're unfamiliar with the Democrats. Mm-hmm. And then the Tribune, which is a nonpartisan, nonprofit news organization, and I'm not saying they're not, but weirdly, the editorial choice was to pack all the news about Republican candidates in the top half of the story and all the news about Republican candidates in the bottom half of the story.
Democratic candidates. You said Republican candidates twice.
Oh, well, okay.
It's okay. It happens.
Yes. All right. Well, you get my drift. Anyhow, that is why it may seem that when I'm reading the story, I'm focusing more on the Democratic percentages, because I feel like maybe I'll correct the editorial decision of the Tribune. In the Democratic primary races, 57% and 52% of voters said they hadn't thought enough about lieutenant governor or attorney general matchups, respectively, a result that points to how Democrats still face an uphill battle to get their candidates elected to statewide office as they push against longtime Republican dominance. According to Blank, in most cases, their candidates are not well known to begin with because they're not drawing from a bench of formerly elected statewide leaders. The task of introducing oneself to the electorate is extremely difficult in a state as large as Texas. It's not only geographically large, but it's also a diverse media landscape in which a statewide ad in all of Texas's media markets can be prohibitively expensive for most candidates. And so this is the disadvantage Democrats always face. When asked to choose, 46% of voters who said they'd participate in the Democratic primary picked the 2018 lieutenant governor candidate Mike Collier, with State Rep. Michelle Beckley, Democrat of Carrollton, coming away with 27%, and Carla Braley, the former vice chair of the Texas Democratic Party, getting 23%. For the attorney general primary, Rochelle Garza, a former lawyer for the American Civil Liberties Union, was the choice of 41% of polled voters who said they'll participate in the Democratic primary. Former Galveston Mayor Joe Jaworski garnered 24% of survey takers' support. Civil rights attorney Lee Merritt came away with 15%, and former Harris County Judge Mike Fields garnered 11%. On topics, issues, if you will, the poll found that 62% of survey takers oppose efforts by some politicians to remove books from public school libraries, including 47% who strongly oppose such efforts. 39% of respondents said they supported such efforts. 9% did not know or indicated no opinion. This is just one of the issue surveys, I think, that I find philosophically concerning. Regarding parental influence in schools, 44% said they thought parents had enough influence over what their children were taught, while 41% said they did not think so. 15% said they did not know or had no opinion. Last year, Texas passed a near-total ban on abortion that thrust the state into the national spotlight over restrictions on the procedure. Now, here's the thing. 43% of respondents said abortion laws in Texas should be made less strict. 23% of respondents indicated the laws should be left as they are, and 23% said restrictions should be even more strict. So, to put that another way, 46% of Texas respondents said that either the rules for against abortion were either strict enough or they need to be even stricter. That's concerning. Additionally, voters were split over the stringency of Texas's voting laws, which were tightened across the board in a sweeping elections bill this year. 30% said voting rules should be tightened further. 31% said they should be left as they are. 29% said rules should be less strict, and 9% said they didn't know or had no opinion. So 30% and 31% said they either are fine as they are or should be stricter. 29% apparently feel that it should be easier to vote, and 9% apparently didn't give a damn. Again, philosophically, very concerning. Mr. Blank noted that years of conservative governance in Texas, coupled with the recent redistricting process that aimed to entrench the Republican Party's control over the state's politics for the next decade, I would use the words even further, have allowed for the GOP to pass increasingly conservative policies, even without broad appeal among the electorate. Blank said, currently, it's hard not to look at the broader public opinion landscape and not see a lot of either conflict in issues that have split the electorate down the middle or outright opposition in some cases to a lot of the banner legislation that was passed in the last year. So having read this article, and again, this is mostly the bottom half of the article. Interestingly, the top half is almost entirely about Republican races. Democratic races aren't significantly discussed until the bottom half of the article as written. And while the Tribune attempts to be nonpartisan, I think this was an unfortunate editorial choice, and it reinforces the challenges that down-ballot Democrats have. The issues in polling results are concerning, as I've said. I think that we have a lot of voters, potential voters, who are suffering from a lack of information, mm-hmm. an abundance of propaganda, and a certain amount of indifference, which is really scary. Andrew?
Absolutely. I think that the hold that the Republican Party has had on Texas has sort of allowed them to put themselves, position themselves as the default, allowed them to position their views and their politics as the default for a good number of Texans over multiple generations. And so I think that there's I think that a significant factor in these issue responses is that something challenging this these Republican measures and these Republican beliefs on these issues hasn't really been introduced to a lot of people. They haven't really ever had to have a conversation about should abortion be legal? Should it be easier to
there know? Are Texans in their 30s and 40s that have never known a Texas not controlled by Republicans.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and on voting, you know, the idea that, you know, people are trying to steal dead people's identities and use them to vote, that, you know, that's been pushed for God, who knows how long. Certainly as long as I've been aware of politics, that's been an argument from conservatives. And
yeah, it's a zero percentage. It's not only
right.
statistically small, it's numerically tiny.
Right. You know, the old sort of point about propaganda is if you hear anything often enough, you eventually start to believe it to some degree. And so I think that that's quite significantly in play for a lot of the average people of Texas. They just aren't having these assumptions by the state leadership challenged. And so they don't know to challenge them. They just think to go along with them. I also think in sort of proposing a potential solution maybe for the Texas Democrats in terms of not getting their candidates' names out there, this is actually an issue that minor parties, and I'm more familiar with the Greens, face very often. We get I guess I can say we get almost no real coverage from, you know, most media. And so it's very difficult to and, you know, we often don't have huge amounts of political donations.
Do we want to get to the point of how Democrats can do this?
Yes. I'm just trying to sort of give some background here.
I'm just looking at the clock.
Yeah, I know. So what we've had to come up with is alternative methods. And one example that I can give is in 2016, the Texas Green Party promoted down ballot candidates by creating slate yard signs rather than just presidential ones. Now, the presidential candidates had their faces and names biggest on the signs, but other big statewide candidates, governor, railroad commissioner, that Supreme Court, that sort of thing, also had their names on those yard signs. Now, I think yard signs are one thing, but I think that this is more a broader tactic. Democrats should think along those lines. What promotions of big candidates that they're already doing can be turned into slate promotions that sort of let down ballot candidates hang on for the ride?
I think that's an interesting thought. I think yard signs are problematic because the whole point is to have something big enough to read as you're going past it.
Sure.
However, when candidates take out billboards, or if you have parties taking out billboards, I think that might be a really good idea. You see enough billboards with enough names, the names become familiar. Mm. And, you know, for a primary, the party doesn't like to endorse particular candidates unless there is some kind of overwhelming reason
True.
To do so.
True.
But as you say, you can still show a slate, portions of a slate, the top yeah. quarter of the slate, whatever, something and, to make and, names familiar.
And there's nothing preventing primary candidates from sort of, at least not as far as I know, preventing primary candidates from pulling, yeah, other candidates on for other offices that they like, they know they work well with, pulling them into their own ad campaigns.
And for travelers, you might be interested in knowing, if you haven't heard, that Frontier and Spirit are going to merge, creating America's fifth largest airline. Frontier and Spirit Airlines, the two largest low-cost carriers in the U.S., have agreed to merge, creating what would become the fifth largest airline in the country. This transaction, I love this. This is typical corporate talk. This transaction is centered around creating an aggressive, ultra-low-fare competitor to serve our guests even better, said Spirit CEO Ted Christie in a statement about the agreement. So, I mean, my perspective here is now, instead of having two really unpleasant airlines to fly, you'll only have one. But the good news is their routes don't overlap much, so it's not going to change much of anything. Andrew? Mm.
Well, I don't know if a merger can ever be called good since it reduces competition and consumer choice, but hey, at least it's not two of the big airlines merging.
You've been listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on Houston's community station, 90.1 KPFT HD2. My co-host and indispensable editor is Andrew Ferguson. We hope you found the show interesting and informative, and we'll look forward to speaking to you again next week. Take care.
See you later.
Robin Lewis, and I work in the membership department here at KPFT. Nearly all of KPFT's operating budget comes from listeners. It's hard to believe that you can run a radio station on the honor system, but it is true. Listeners decide to make a contribution to support KPFT because they know it can't work any other way. To keep this service strong and independent, it must be powered by the very public it serves. Your friends are contributing neighbors, co-workers, clients, Houston residents. Listener contributions are the single largest source of revenue for KPFT. That's why your contribution means so much right now. Please renew your support of KPFT or make your first contribution now. You can give online at kpft.org or call 713-526-5738. Or you can also text the word GIVE to 713-526-5738. In reply, you'll get a link that'll help you donate to the station. We hope that you'll join us, and thank you.
This is Quantum Leap Radio. I am the Grandfather Clock.
And I am your girl, Dope Courtney, a.k.a. Dopico Jones, and we are excited.
No.
Oh, wait. I said it, didn't I? I'm sorry. This is your girl, Dope A. Courtney, a.k.a. Dopico Jones.
I want to tell the people that we are now in their ear on a Saturday.
Our new time is 9 a.m. to 11 a.m.
That's right, where they can get the hip-hop of the past, present, and possibly future.
You want to find us on the HD2 channel at 9 a.m.
KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston, HD.2, or worldwide at kpft.org/listen under the HD2 link, or you can actually find us on the Pacifica Radio app. This is Houston's community station. We are Quantum Leap Radio.
Thank you.